But to start with, we're going to meet some terrorists through my first guest, Jessica Stern, who teaches a course on terrorism at Harvard and has spent the last 4 years interviewing terrorists both inside and outside the USA. In the introduction to her book, Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill, Jessica talks about the notion of evil. She writes, there are three kinds of evil, moral, natural and metaphysical, but the great German thinker, Hannah Arendt, observed another kind of moral evil, and I quote, men who comply unthinkingly with evil rulers, regulations or unfair systems, perpetrating unspeakably cruel acts. In this banal form of evil, perpetrators shut off the knowledge that their victims are human beings. It is this kind of evil that I observe in the terrorists described in these pages. Now, I find it extraordinary that Jessica's given her life to studying not just terrorism, but super-terrorism, because until recently, she was the super-terrorism fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. What an extraordinary title, and why the interest?
To be honest, I just sort of fell into this. I was trained originally as a chemist, and I went to live in the Soviet Union and became interested in national security affairs. And when I ended up writing a doctoral dissertation on chemical weapons threats, I also included an assessment of chemical weapons terrorism, not realizing, of course, how important this would come to be.
Well, let's look at the intellectual chemistry of terrorism now. As I told the listeners earlier, you interviewed four terror in the name of God, Christians, Jews, Muslims, all believing that they were killing for God. And was this ability not to empathise with their victims as human unanimous amongst these militants?
Well, there are different ways they defended themselves from understanding that what they were doing was truly evil. One was to deny that the groups that they were involved in were involved in deliberately targeting non-combatants. And either by saying, I'm now thinking about a Hamas leader saying that no Israeli child is truly an innocent civilian, since every Israeli civilian will become a soldier. Or by just denying that the group, claiming that the group only targets military personnel, or by dehumanizing the enemy in one way or another. Some of the identity Christians think of blacks as falling between apes and human beings. They're not really human beings. And Jews as being the literal offspring of Eve and the snake. So that becomes a way not to feel the pain of having done something so terrible, I think.
An extraordinary notion. Michael, let's dwell on the domestic terrorist. Let's look at Kerry Noble, who served, 5 years in jail as a result of his actions when he belonged to a right-wing Christian cult, the Christian Identity Movement. Now, this is an apocalyptic sect who are against Jews, blacks, abortion and the government. Connected to McVeigh in any way?
There is the possibility that this cult, which was located on an armed compound and active in the mid-1980s, may have given Timothy McVeigh the idea to target the Oklahoma City Federal Building. That cult had earlier planned to target precisely the same building, and we know that Timothy McVeigh made a phone call out to another armed compound where the former leader of that cult was living right before the bombing.
Jessica, when you sit down and talk to a character like this, are you talking to someone who's insane, or are you talking to someone who, for most practical purposes, is perfectly normal?
Well, when I first started the project and I heard, in fact, Kerry Noble telling me my group thought that we were carrying out God's judgments by planning to kill large numbers of people with cyanide in major cities, and that would persuade the Messiah to return more quickly, I thought, well, that sounded, certainly I had to consider the possibility he was insane.
This doesn't sound at all well, does he?
But I brought a psychologist with me to visit him, where he was living when he was out of prison in a trailer park in Texas, and the psychologist said that we need to see this as a kind of group insanity. It's not necessarily that the individuals that get involved in these groups are insane. And he felt that Carrie Noble was not insane, but that the group, there's a group dynamic that takes hold. And I think most of the people I spoke with, that was the way they seemed. They didn't seem completely irrational. It was possible to follow the moral logic that led them to the conclusion that it was okay to do what every religion tells us is not okay, that is.
Jessica, to achieve the state of mind, you've got to be alienated, and to achieve alienation, it would seem that you've got to live apart and collectively. That was certainly the case with this Christian cult, wasn't it?
Yes, not all of these groups live apart and collectively, but I think that what happens is leaders find a way to strengthen, almost construct, a deeper feeling of alienation and humiliation. Humiliation is a critical factor. And explain that this is your enemy. This is your enemy who's making you feel humiliated. And the way to restore your dignity is to pick up the gun. And this is something that all these groups have in common. Zawahiri, for example, has written about that globalization is humiliating to Islam, and that Muslims can restore their dignity only by participating in a global jihad.
We had Bernard Henri Lévy on. Now, he was running the line that the Muslim militant, the zealot that's, let's say, attacking the United States, is the bastard child, and that's a metaphor, the bastard child of Islam and affluent Europe. Did you talk to Islamic militants in Pakistan, for example, and to see whether poverty was a considerable factor?
Yes, I think in poor countries, poverty is a considerable factor. It doesn't mean that poverty causes terrorism, but not by any means. If it did, we'd see a lot more terrorism in Africa, for example.
The question was clumsy, but the fact is that many terrorists are not poor at all, are they?
That's right. Many terrorists are not poor at all, but leaders can find a way to capitalize on poverty, to take advantage of poor people. And Pakistan is one of the best examples because the extremist madrasas function as orphanages for the children of the very poor, and those children end up serving as cannon fodder in various purported jihads around the world.
This is Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, a program from January 2004. My guest is Jessica Stern, author of Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. You interviewed James Dalton Bell, who's the MIT-trained chemist, a fellow professional who wanted revenge on the US government. How did he use the internet?
Well, he is a very interesting character partly because he was so bright. He was extremely talented chemist, and that was obvious from a very young age. But he got very mad at the U.S. government, in particular the Internal Revenue Service, because he owed back taxes that he didn't want to pay. And he came up with a scheme to encourage the murder of so-called slimeballs and miscreants, otherwise known as IRS agents. It was an internet scheme that would allow participants to donate digital cash to reward the murderers of these slimeballs and miscreants. And the government had to take this scheme pretty seriously, especially when they found what he was doing, playing with chemicals and biological agents. Some of which I don't know the full details. It's not in the public domain.
Yeah. It's funny. The book is an examination of evil, trying to understand the mechanisms, trying to be, in a sense, non-judgmental is a clumsy thing, but not demonizing, simply trying to get inside the minds of these people. And one of the people that you examine is a Paul Hill, who's a Christian anti-abortionist, who killed a doctor, knowing that he would be sentenced to death, and also knowing that he'd leave his two sons without a father. He obviously, the notion of evil occurs to Paul Hill, but the doctor is the evil person, not him.
Yes. That was a chilling interview. This is a man who really sees himself, or saw himself, he actually was recently executed, as akin to Jesus Christ. He really saw himself as a very, very important martyr, serving a very important function, and that it was worth it to orphan his two children to achieve this goal. And this kind of grandiosity is not that uncommon, especially among the individuals attracted to violent extremist groups in the United States. I think that in the Islamist groups, there's a much broader appeal. There's a much broader sense of humiliation and grievance. There's a much bigger pull of young people to attract into the movement, whereas one meets more unusual characters in the identity Christian and anti-abortion groups in the United States.
It must have been a little bit difficult for you organizing some of these interviews, given that you have a Jewish name. Did any of your subjects find that an impediment to candor, or did they refuse to talk to you?
There was only one case where I failed to persuade someone to talk to me because of my name, and that was Hamas in Jordan. When they heard my name, they said, under no circumstances would they talk to me, and so I just got on a bus and went to Gaza, and from there it was very easy to contact Hamas. That was the only time this came up. Sometimes my interlocutors, if they knew I was Jewish, took the opportunity to explain their conspiracy theories about how Jews are running and ruining the world, even though they had never seen a Jew before and really knew very little about
it. And, of course, it was Jews that blew up the World Trade Center, wasn't it?
Yes, that is one of the theories.
Yeah, yes. I think the book is very timely. You come from a culture, and I'm talking about the US in its totality, which is pretty good at demonizing, but not very good at comprehending the nature of terror. And it seems to me that you are now in a better situation than most to actually make suggestions about countering terrorism. Do you have some recommendations?
Well, one of the things I found in the groups that become professional, and those, of course, are all Islamist groups, those are the groups that we're all worried about today, is that people who join these groups over time become professionals, and there isn't really a lot we can do to change their minds. Sometimes they, over time, end up doing what they do for the money, and that's a good thing for us because it means we might be able to lure them away. But it's very unlikely we will alter their view of the world. But what's most important is that we pay attention to those who are potential recruits, who are sitting on the fence, who at this point don't know whether they should have more faith in Osama bin Laden or President Bush. And this is something that I feel the U.S. government has really... We've made some very profound errors, and you can see after the war in Iraq, polls show that in a number of Muslim-majority countries, majorities actually do have more confidence in bin Laden than President Bush, and I think this is deeply troubling.
You say that we need to avoid giving into spiritual dread and to hold fast to the best of our principles by emphasizing tolerance, empathy, and courage. Well, yeah, fine. It's pretty hard to sell that story, I guess, to Americans at the moment.
Yes, in many ways, we're undergoing almost a Salem witch trial type situation where ordinary Muslims are turning in their enemies, claiming, making up stories about their involvement in training camps, and it's fairly frightening. I think that Americans are beginning to realize that in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, we may have given the Justice Department a bit more power than we should have.
One of the arguments about terrorists is that there's always, always, invariably religious zealotry. But it seems to me from other discussions I've had over the last couple of years that often in the case of, say, Palestinian suicide bombers, that they're not necessarily intensely religious at all. There are other factors in their decision to blow themselves and others up.
Yes, that's true across the board. It's not true just of Palestinians. In fact, the Tamil Tigers have long been employing this tactic, and it's usually, more often than not, women are the ones who are the suicide bombers. I think we shouldn't assume that religious faith or perverted religious faith is the only element. There are many elements that lead people to join these movements, and there is usually a leader who can describe a grievance in a compelling way. In the case of the Tamil Tigers, there's a charismatic leader who really is viewed almost as a god. And there are financial incentives. There are emotional incentives. Many of the people I've talked to who have joined these groups will admit that the feeling that their work is glamorous or that they have an adventurous life is an important part of the appeal.
And also, quite often, a large cash payment is made. In the case of some of the jihadi groups, well, the family of the martyr is paid between $25,000 and $100,000.
Right. I think this, we can see this in some ways as a way to keep the families quiescent. It's very unlikely that mothers would put up with this without protest, and this is a method to for the most part keep them quiet, as I see it. But of course, it does encourage, it does keep the process going in a kind of tragic cycle.
Jessica, has there been, in your view? It's not something you cover in the book, but I wonder if you know whether there's been a slackening off of domestic militia-type terror in the US as a result of facing a common enemy, if you like, in militant Islam.
Not at all. The identity Christian, white supremacist, neo-Nazi groups, many of them are strongly supportive of al-Qaeda and applaud what occurred on September 11th.
And really? And what's the rational, well, the irrationalization of that?
There is this, first of all, what they have a strong, almost mystical anti-globalization agenda in common. For the identity Christians, global institutions such as the United Nations and the IMF and the World Bank are literal manifestations of the Antichrist, whereas for Zawahiri, they are instruments of American hegemony. Al-Qaeda views international institutions such as the United Nations as a weapon in America's arsenal. So we shouldn't be surprised that they would be targeting the UN. That's something very important they have in common. And, of course, they also oppose the U.S. government in general and feel that globalization is destroying local cultures in one way or another. And they both have it in for the Jews. So they have quite a bit in common.
Jessica Stern spent 4 years interviewing terrorists in the course of writing Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. Jessica is a lecturer at Harvard University's School of Government. Classic LNL on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. And this program was first broadcast in January 2004.